Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at offbeatoregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. It's Tuesday, so this is an archive show, first published as a newspaper column and podcast episode several years ago. More than two, less than ten. Thanks for downloading, and I hope you enjoy it. This story was first published on October 5th of 2014 under the headline, Jefferson's Secession of 1941 was largely a publicity stunt. Here we go. Most Oregonians know about the state of Jefferson, in general concept at least. A small group of Southern Oregon people got together in 1941 to proclaim a new state made up of Southwest Oregon and Northwest California and called it Jefferson. Just as they got started, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, and the idea just never got off the ground. All of which is true enough, but it barely touches the real story of Jefferson, and it's not even the most interesting part. The fact is, the 1941 move for statehood was mostly a publicity stunt. It was crafted over drinks by two guys who seemed straight out of central casting for a Hollywood movie, a high-rolling, back-slapping business promoter, and a hard-drinking, wildly imaginative newspaper man. The newsman actually won a Pulitzer Prize for his part in the affair. His name was Stanton Delaplane, and he wrote for the San Francisco Chronicle. The business promoter was a stocky, dynamic man named Gilbert E. Gable, a one-time dinosaur egg hunter, movie maker, NBC radio show star, and, he claimed, Navajo Indian chief. Unquestionably one of the most colorful characters ever to set foot in Oregon. In 1941, he was mayor of the tiny town of Port Orford, and for a brief and shining moment, he was the governor of the great state of Jefferson. Well, sort of. Gilbert Elodie Gable was born in Pennsylvania in the late 1880s. Although he never went to college, he quickly found his way into public relations and spent 9 years as a publicity man for Theodore Vail's Bell Telephone Company. As you may know, I teach history of telecommunications at Oregon State University. Being a publicity man for Theodore Vail's Bell Telephone Company was a big deal. During this time, under Vail's direction, Bell transitioned from the most hated company in the nation to one of the most trusted, publicly committed to using its market dominance to bring telephone service to the remotest outposts of America. That story is more than we can get into in this article, but it is one of history's greatest public relations triumphs, and Gable was a part of it, although I have been unable to learn how big a role he played there. The phone business must have been good to him, though, because after the war, Gable became an explorer and an amateur paleontologist, and of course, these are things that it takes money to do. He discovered a vast assortment of dinosaur tracks in Arizona, as well as a lost ancient Indian village, and claimed to have been made an honorary chief of the Navajo people, a claim that he backed up with a certificate that was, quote, written in human blood. He made a number of dinosaur hunting expeditions to the Painted Desert area until in 1929 the governor of Arizona ordered police to prevent, quote, Dr. Gable from removing any more fossils or artifacts. That had to be awkward. But he also made movies. In 1927, as vice president of Bray Motion Pictures, he won publicity for the silent movie Menace by bringing a film crew down the wild Colorado River on a boat through the Grand Canyon, a feat that was breathlessly described in the papers as fraught with deadly peril. By the early 1930s, Gable had gotten involved in the new world of radio broadcasting with an NBC show called Highway of Adventure, sometimes listed as High Road to Adventure, in which he recounted spine-tingling moments from the previous dozen years of hunting for dinosaur eggs and exploring unknown landscapes. He also sought and won the hand of Miss Paulina Stearns, daughter of a wealthy Michigan timber family. And then, in 1933, he went to Port Orford, probably to search for the legendary Port Orford meteorite, although that isn't ever quite made clear. It was, however, a historic moment indeed. Quote, 2 years later, to the amazement of its 300 inhabitants, Gilbert Gable appeared at Port Orford, Oregon, and formed six companies to promote it as the only natural deep water harbor on the rugged coast between Puget Sound and the Golden Gate, reports Time magazine in its rather supercilious 1938 article. Gable hit Port Orford like a temperate zone hurricane. He was convinced that the nearby countryside was peppered with deposits of copper and gold and other resources, all covered over with billions of board feet of old-growth timber. The harbor, having no river to complicate navigation with a bar to fight through, was just a million-dollar jetty away from becoming the perfect port. But of course, it would also need a railroad line. For a while, things went very well indeed. Quote, "Since 1935, Gilbert Gable has wrought such changes in southwestern Oregon that the region has been called his empire," Time magazine reported in April of 1938. "But last week, Emperor Gable was dethroned by the Interstate Commerce Commission," the article continued. It was the railroad line that was taking Gable down. The railroad line and the sea. Just 3 months after Gable, now mayor of Port Orford, dedicated the harbor in a splendid ceremony before dignitaries from all over the state, the massive new Trans-Pacific and Port Orford Dock and Terminal Line Company breakwater collapsed in a huge storm. A temporary pier was soon built, but it didn't afford the kind of protection that the harbor would need, and Gable's backers weren't willing to invest in a railroad line to service a harbor that might not be capable of functioning as more than a temporary port of refuge. In 1938, an ICC examiner quashed the whole plan, opining that Port Orford was never going to be an important center of commerce, or Crescent City either, and pulling both cities' Certificate of Convenience and Necessity, and with that, Gable's permit to build a railroad line. Now Gable was caught in a catch-22. Without a railroad connection, his backers wouldn't help him finance the necessary repair and beefing up of the harbor jetty. Without a beefed-up jetty protecting the harbor, the ICC wouldn't issue a permit to build a railroad. An increasingly desperate Gable looked to the state for help in getting the highways improved so that the mining, logging, and shipping companies that he'd founded could get their produce out to markets overland. But politicians in Salem could barely be bothered to even notice the tiny port city of under 1,000 residents that still cherished hopes of superseding Portland's harbor. Road-building dollars remained in scarce supply. By fall of 1941, Gable was watching his dream slip from his fingers for want of a railroad link. He started thinking about ways to bring pressure on the state to help him out. He started advocating for Curry County to split off from Oregon and become part of California, a suggestion that seems to have yielded amusement, alarm, and ridicule in roughly equal measures from the governments of both states, but nothing more. The suggestion did bring something else, though. It brought a visit from one of the West Coast's most enterprising and colorful newspaper men, Stanton Delaplane. Gable and Dell hit it off immediately. Soon the two of them were cooped up together in a cozy office with a bottle of 150-proof rum as a hard winter rain pounded the roof, making plans that would soon blossom into an apparently serious proposal to secede from the state outright. We'll talk about those plans and their implementation next week. Key sources in this story have included works by Peter Laufer, Gilbert Gable, and Time magazine. That's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. More information is at our hub page, offbeatoregon.com. Offbeat Oregon is a division of Pulplit Productions, a boutique publishing house about which more can be learned at pulp-lit.com. Speaking of which, if you enjoy listening to me, you might check out my other podcast, the weekly Friedrich Wilhelm von Jungst Library of Forgotten Worlds podcast. It's basically readings of classic pulp stories. You can find it with a search for Von Jungst, V-O-N space J-U-N-Z-T, on iTunes or on your podcatcher. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Want to visit about Oregon history or anything else? Email me for any reason or for no reason at all at fj@offbeatoregon.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday morning, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.